Jim Bouie from the Bristol District, right here where we sit, out in Bristol.
James Keane, rural at large, from Grant.
Mr. Rich.
Jim Rich from the Calvert District.
Greg Worley, Commission for VDOT.
Thelma Drake, Director, Department of Rail and Public Transportation.
Doug Cooley, Northern Virginia District.
Aubrey Lane, Hampton Roads District.
Mark Peets, Lynchburg District.
I'm Chuck Miller, Urban at Large member, and I live in Norman.
And Roger Cole from the Richmond District.
Thank you very much. At this point, we'll get right into the agenda for the workshop, starting with Easy Pass marketing. Ms. Johnson.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, Commissioner, Director Drake, board members. I am very pleased to be here. I am representing a collaboration between communication and financial planning. I am the lucky one who gets to go over Easy Pass this month, but I have my colleagues, John Lawson and Law Farmer, who have promised that if I get stuck with any question, they'd be very quick to jump up. This morning, the presentation will address the following. We'll talk about our goals, the key roles, toll facilities, transponders, the types, the quantity, status, acquisition, retail location, Easy Pass on the go, and our marketing efforts. We're going to start with our goals. Easy Pass is expanded to support the opening of new toll facilities beginning this summer. We want to raise awareness, provide convenience and availability, and create synergy. Key roles, and this is a very important thought. We will provide the transponders, the retail program, and related customer service, while the operators will promote the facilities and toll usage. Our partners will deploy paid agents. And if you look at this slide, it tells you what VDOT and our contractor, which is FanDuel, what they will provide and what the toll facility will provide. And, you know, we do the transponders, we'll find retail locations, websites, customer service centers, in-store marketing materials, earned media, newsletters, the Easy Pass. But the toll facilities would have the heavy lift. They would be paying for the radio, print, and TV advertising, billboards, incentives, promotion, events, marketing material. And the new toll facilities that we have coming on board, Jordan Bridge, that's in the Hampton Roads area, opens July 2012. Anticipated 7,000 Easy Pass users. 495 Express Line opens December 12, 2012. 225,000 users. Easy Pass flex users along with the standard Easy Pass. Elizabeth River Crossing, that's the downtown Midtown MLK expansion. Tolling begins January 2014. The facility will not open in 2014, but the tolling will begin in 2014.
Mr. Chairman, ask a question.
Yes, Mr.
These are additional user passes that we're expecting. How many do we have now? How many users? Do you know how many user passes we have in the state now?
About 9.
This is a pretty substantial increase, almost double than what we're.
Okay, thank you.
For the Jordan Bridge, they're anticipating 7,000. We have those in stock already at the Clifton Forge Customer Service Center. We anticipate opening the Chesapeake DMV location, June 1st target. We're going to co-locate with the Jordan Bridge office starting June 1. Retail locations, we have not secured any retail locations as of yet, but things will pick up with the anticipation of the start for the downtown Midtown tunnel. You do know that to get retailers to engage in selling EasyPass transponders, it is a business proposition. And we feel relatively certain that once downtown Midtown comes on board, it will be a lot easier to secure retail businesses in the Hampton Roads area. Promotional activities, Jordan Bridge, they're having activities every other Saturday. They're planning a bridge opening event. They have radio, print, and online advertising, direct mail, and they're doing that June through July, and then the earned media. 495 Express Lane. This is the one that's been getting quite a lot of attention. We have been working very closely with Transurban. As a matter of fact, Transurban came in and they sat down with our contractor, Spanuel, and we discussed how we were going to handle our marketing plan. They need 100,000 flex responders by June 30th, and we're well on our way to accomplishing that. Another 125 will be delivered through 2012 on a monthly basis. Tyson's Corner DMV will open on July 16th. We are looking at other locations, but we have firm commitment to July 16th for the DMV location. On retail locations, I'll get into that in the next slide. We're going to do in-store marketing, PR activities, online, print, and of course there will be a procrastinator campaign. Because you know, even though they may start selling them on July 1st, they're going to be those folks who are going to wait until November when the facility opens in December to get their transplants. Downtown Midtown MLK, Little River Crossing, they're anticipating 100,000 transponders, 90% already in stock. We are anticipating opening a DMV location in Norfolk and Portsmouth in fall of 2013. But as I said on the George Bridge line, we do have a DMV that will be opening in Chesapeake in June. We're going to do in-store marketing, community outreach, earned media, and ERC will have incentives. Now this is the types of transponders. We're going to have the EasyPass standard, which we can use on all of our toll facilities. You will be able to use the standard EasyPass on the 495 Express Lane. Then you have the EasyPass Flex. And that's primarily for 495 and will be used for 95 Express Lines when they open. Now the transponders include an HOV mode switch where you can switch from for the 3+ occupants. Because you will be in garage 3 if you have 3+. Now this is a slide that we got a lot of conversation about the last time. But this is just to ensure you that we will have the appropriate amount, number of transponders when the facilities open. When Joint Bridge opens, we've got their 7,000 that they're going to need. When Transurban starts their marketing push July 1st, we will have their flex transponders and their standard transponders. And we will have what they need to get through their first wave demand. How can you get a transponder? How can you find it? Acquisition. You can apply online 24/7 at the website. Over 60% of our customers obtain their EasyPass online. And 92% replenish their EasyPass online. We have a toll-free number from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And when you use the toll-free or call or do go online, they're shipped within 2 days. We have 3 existing customer service centers, Coleman Customer Service, Northern Virginia, and the Richmond area. We're doing a launch phase approach. For the DMV facilities, we're opening the Chesapeake June 1st. Tyson's Corner, July 16th, Norfolk and Portsmouth, targeted for 2013, and we're exploring other DMV locations. Retail distribution. We have 3 major retailers whose agreements are in their legal department currently, and we anticipate having signed agreements within a couple of weeks, a week or so. Yes, I look back at my colleagues. Give me that nod. have one major change that has 40 locations in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. So I said earlier that we did not have any retail locations for Hampton Roads, but this major chain will open in Northern Virginia, and then they will then start servicing Hampton Roads when the downtown Midtown comes up. We have one large gas station which services 300 customers a day. They have about 200 for gas and about 70 repairs a day. And as Transurban describes this company, if you're familiar with the Subway commercial when you have, I can't think of the guy's name, but he's the one who's lost all this weight, and he's the biggest person who represents Subway.
Jerry.
Thank you. Well, this gas station owner is the Jerry who transferred. He approached them, and he's very excited about them. We also negotiate with 14 other outlets that have facilities in Northern Virginia, and they have facilities in Hampton Roads. We have initiated discussions with 15 other large retailers. We have reduced the minimum order from 1,800 to 200 transponders. That is the biggest thing for this slide, and that was to encourage retailers, because it was kind of daunting for them to get 1,800 at one time, but with 200 transponders, we think that'll be a easier sell. Now this comes to the fun part. How does it work? If you're familiar with the lottery sign and the store window, this is what will be in the store. And this will indicate that you can purchase your EZ Pass. I feel like Santa Claus.
Can I buy a vowel? What's your guess?
North Carolina is not looking to join the EZ Pass network.
have not signed on yet, but we are in heavy negotiations with North Carolina and expect them to join as a national affiliate.
Thank you.
Yes.
This is 495 is open road tolling, right? So if you enter without an easy pass, it'll take your license plate. Now, I've got an easy pass flex, and I've turned it off. Is it sophisticated enough to know that I have an easy pass I've turned off that doesn't take my license plate picture?
Turned off. One way or another.
In other words, so it knows not to bill me. It knows that I shouldn't be billed.
The flex tag is not an on-off switch.
Right.
It always operates. What the HOB nomination does is it tells the system that you have three passengers and so don't bill me.
Gotcha. Okay, just want to make sure. Thank you.
Chair?
Yes.
I just want to make a point that I made before. In other areas, you can use a credit card. And I don't see why we haven't looked into that more carefully. I think we need to make these transactions very user-friendly. And in my rural district, if you told the folks they had to buy a plastic box from the government to get on the road, their Second Amendment rights would come out and it's in full view. But I think we ought to consider a credit card use.
Yes, sir.
Mr.
Dennis. Mr. Colton. Yes, Dennis.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. A couple of questions. Does the retailer pay for the initial inventory of 200 and
yes.
pays what?
You have to pay within 30 days.
How much does he pay per unit?
$31.
So he's making $4 on the transaction. Are there any residual benefits that, you know, as the transponder is replenished? Pretty low margin transaction for a fair amount of money, I think. Sign up $6,000. Have you all received any negative response from retailers? Or?
There are a couple of retailers who want a large profit margin.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Dallas?
That was my question.
So can we go back to slide 11?
Excuse me, sir?
Slide 11. Mr.
Pickle. How do you verify when they switch to three or more? Do you use the photo ID to verify that they have three or more? And if they switch to three or more and really only have one, what is the penalty?
Collaboration between financial planning and marketing. Please don't leave. Yes, Mr. Secretary.
All right, so we're 6 weeks out from your saying July 1st. And right now we don't have any retail contracts.
Correct, sir. But I assure you that we will have contracts. Transurban is helping us with some of the negotiations. They've made a few phone calls. It is a collaborative effort, and I feel very confident in standing here telling you, sir, that we will have contracts.
Okay, so when you're back up before us next month, you're going to...
When I stand here next month, I will be able to give you the names of the companies that we're negotiating with and those who have signed contracts.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
You're so welcome, sir.
Can't wait to see you again, Ms. Johnson.
As you told me last night, free the transponder.
Free the transponder. Let them run out on our highways. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, yes. I wanted to know, do you guys have cardboard signs just in case they don't come? Where you'll be standing out on the highway selling them?
Well, I did have an idea. Maybe I could get you all to assist me at the rest areas and you can pass them up.
I think Mr. Miller would be excellent at that position.
No, sir. We are working together collaboratively. And as I can't call out the names because you can't negotiate and tell the companies that you're working with. But no, sir, we will have signed contracts. And if not, Mr. Secretary,
what?
I won't stand here. Let somebody else do it.
That's a true vote of confidence.
But no, we will have it, sir.
We applaud Mr. Lawson for allowing somebody else to do the report. He just got tired of taking all the
They decided that I was, they said they throw me out there and that I could take it.
Never pick on a woman.
When my backup plan is the questions that got too hard, I was going to cry.
No crying in transportation.
All righty.
But thank you very much.
Yes, Mr. Johnson, can't wait.
No crying at the CTB.
Yeah, that's right.
Route 460 update. Mr. Holcomb.
I want to see the rest area campaign. That would be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, board members. I've been asked to give two updates today, project briefs, one on the 460 project, one on the I-95 Hot Lanes project in Northern Virginia. I'll start out with the Route 460 project. I have Chris Lemons with me in the audience to answer any legal questions associated with the structure that we're going to go over on the Route 460 project. First two slides will talk about some background information on the project. You've heard this before. We have three offers on the project: Central Infrastructures, 460 Partners, and Multimodal Solutions. We had meetings, proprietary meetings, with each of the proposers last week to talk about this structure. They were very productive meetings. The commissioner met with each of the proposers one-on-one and talked to them. From what I got from it, and certainly Commissioner Worley can bring anything up, but certainly I thought they were positive meetings, and I think all are going to stay in under the procurement process that we have in place. We have a competitive procurement. The award is going to be based on the lowest present value of the public subsidy. In other words, all three are going to be looking at the financial structure. They're going to bring financing to the project, and they're going to bid the lowest public subsidy towards the project. Each of the financial proposals will be have an investment grade rating on the funding that they're bringing to the project. The cost of the project is going to be a fixed price, fixed date, design build cost, which will range anywhere between $1.5 and $2 billion. We're hoping the competitive environment that is brought about by the three proposers will even reduce that more and reduce the public subsidy on the project. This is just a picture of the corridor. You've seen this many times, a 55-mile corridor, a four-lane divided highway. There are going to be seven interchanges and then the two terminus. It goes from Suffolk to Petersburg, coming out of the Hampton Roads area and coming south out of the Richmond-Petersburg area. What I want to do over the next few slides is set a stage. This is a different type of project. A lot of the projects that we've talked about in the past are concession model type projects, like the 95 Expressway, 495 Expressway, Midtown Tunnel. Those are concession type models. This one is going to be a design, build, finance type model. And I'll get into a little bit more of the structure of what a design, build, finance is in a couple of slides. But there are some reasons that we're implementing a design, build, finance approach on this one. The toll revenues in the early years are going to be very, very limited. We just don't think the traffic's going to be there first, but we think it's going to grow over time. For example, in 2018, when we think the facility is going to be on board, there'll be about $14 million worth of revenue generated on the project, increasing over time, where in 2020, $18 million, 2030, about $28 million. So increasing over time. We think the traffic is going to come. We think the growth along the corridor is going to be there, and we think the revenues are going to be higher. But in the early years, the revenue is going to be pretty low. It's going to be a greenfield project, which greenfield project means it's going to be a new facility. It's not an established facility like the Midtown Tunnel or 495. And the risk of a greenfield type project in the from the private sector's perspective is very high. We're going to be creating a financial structure that looks for the cheapest type of debt. And I'll go through that a little bit later of the structure that we have that's looking for that cheapest type of debt that doesn't affect the Commonwealth's debt rate. In speaking with Commissioner Worley and others at VDOT, VDOT wanted to take a greater role because of the increased contribution that they're putting towards the project. They want a greater role in setting the tolls over the term of the contract. They want a greater role in setting the toll escalation parameters. If there are rewards associated with the revenues that are being generated in the later years, they also want to be a part of that because of the contribution that the Commonwealth is making for it. And we're looking for a shorter term on the project. Hopefully it will be no greater than or up to 40 years. Our goal, and hopefully with the revenues coming in, that will be even less than the 40-year period. Continuing with setting the stage of the project, again, we're looking for the least expensive method to build the full scope of the project. We looked at some alternative scopes of the project to try to reduce the cost. We looked at two lanes. We looked at three lanes. We looked at a combination of the two. And really, when we look at the financing of the project, it just wasn't worth it. The revenues that fall off because of the lower scope just doesn't make the project worthwhile. So Commissioner Worley asked us to move forward and try to put a structure together that has a full scope for the project. We're looking at tax-exempt debt through a 6320 corporation, and you'll see a little bit later on, I'm going to go through the structure for that 6320 corporation. We're not looking for the private sector to bring any equity because we know with the type of risk that is on this type of greenfield project, the equity is going to be pretty high. So another way of reducing the cost of the project is bringing no equity to the project itself. So a combination of the public subsidy and the tax-exempt debt is the way we want to try to move forward with the structure. VDOT is going to be taking on the long-term operations of the facility itself. We found that going through an analysis, VDOT is obviously very good at operating facilities. The facility is going to be built new. So in the early years, the first 20 years, we don't think there's going to be a lot of costs associated with the operations and maintenance of the facility. So we wanted to take that out and have VDOT take on that role. So the two things that I really want to talk about and actions that will be in the June time period for the CTV is the formation of the 6320 nonprofit corporation and providing a line of credit through a VTIB loan. And I'll get into a little bit more of that when we go into the slides. I'm going to skip over this slide because I think the benefits need to be explained a little bit after the structure itself. This is the slide I think is going to be a good discussion point between the group itself. What I want to try to do with this is first talk about the entities that are within the structure itself, and then talk about the relationships. The 6320 Corporation is something that we've done in the past. We did it on the 495 Capital Beltway project, and we've done it on the Pocahontas Parkway project. So it is something that the Commonwealth has done in the past on P3 projects. And it's a non-stock, non-profit corporation organized under the Virginia Non-Stock Corporation Act. The 6320 Corporation really is the centerpiece of the structure that we have here. The other entities are obviously VDOT, the design-build contractor, or the offer, the private sector coming in. You'll see on here, yes, sir.
Who are the owners of the 6320 nonprofit?
Well, there will be board members.
Okay.
There will be board members established by the sponsor, which is the Virginia Department of Transportation. So along with the private sector and the Virginia Department of Transportation, there will be corporate board members.
Okay.
Who do you anticipate that would be?
Those corporate board members have not been identified. We'll work with Commissioner Worley and Secretary Knott to identify those and also with the private sector.
We'll be looking for volunteers.
Chris can come up. can identify the structure, but it's usually about 80-20.
Yeah, I'm more interested in sort of what the roles and responsibilities are, what the power is, what the authority is.
Right.
We have one on.
They really do.
So we have one. We have one on 495, right?
We've had one on 495. It's no longer on 495 because it was specifically for the reinvestment of the bonds after commercial close.
Could you just talk about that in Pocahontas, how the board members were selected? Because actually, I don't know. It was before I was here.
The, Mr. Chairman, Chris Lemons, the Attorney General's office. The board members of the same
roles and responsibilities of the board members.
Yeah.
The roles and responsibilities of the board members are set forth in the Articles of Incorporation. It's really just to administer the entity within the fiduciary duties of board members to the law. Really, what the and that would be.
What does that mean?
No operational, no operational question.
No.
Okay, that's what the question was.
No. The very limited role, it's just such that the operation
will be a VDOT.
All the outside.
Toll charging, that would not be a responsibility of this.
And would you anticipate, I know you said you haven't suggested the proper mix, would you anticipate and would it be allowable to have functionally State/DDOT control of the board?
It would be allowable. I don't know what I can anticipate yet for the underground board on that, but
I mean, whenever you're asking one board to create another board, then, you know, we have roles and responsibilities for this board. Obviously, the secretary has roles and responsibilities, and the commissioner, and you set up another board. You know, the import is what can they do and what could they do that we wouldn't want them to do.
Right, and that would be set forth in the Articles of Incorporation, which is governed in the authority of the Constitution Corporation activities. And so, as part of the process of forming the 63-20 Corporation and this board's ultimate approval of its activities and authority, we work closely with the chairman and vice chairman to reflect the desires of this board.
Continuing with the structure itself, you see the 63-20 Corporation, VDOT is going to be a key player in the development of the 63-20 Corporation and the administration of it. You have the offer, the private sector coming in. You see the lines of contract service and cash flow, the three above the 63-20. Certainly the users and the tolls, the toll revenue generated coming to the 63-20 Corporation. The VTIP loan, which I'll talk about a little bit later, as a credit enhancement to the revenues generated for the 63-20 Corporation and the Pakistan debt. The tolling operations will come out of the 63-20 Corporation, but the Virginia Department of Transportation will replace the 63-20 Corporation as its
So the operational control will rest with VDOT.
So the administrative control, we got that. But who would make the ultimate decision on how much the toll would be?
Well, the Virginia Department of Transportation will make that in the development of the comprehensive agreement. So as we develop the comprehensive agreement, we will set the tolls.
And then VDOT will maintain when to raise the tolls. So,
that's correct.
So it'll be VDOT will be making that. Okay, that's my question.
And ultimately, this board's role in terms of approving the structure and or funding it, can you, somewhere in your presentation, I'd like to get to that.
Right. I think there'll be several roles for this board. One is to give us approval from the Board of the 6th Regional Corporation. The second is to move forward with $8 million VTIP loan as credit enhancement for the project itself. And certainly any funding that goes to the project and the funding to the 6-year plan will be this board's approval.
And would the VTIP loan be subordinated to the tax-exempt debt repayment?
Just one more question. VDOT's doing the tolling. That authority rests with them. I'm just trying to get to it. So you legislatively can do the tolling.
Through this PPTA.
Just because it's PPTA. Okay, I just want to see how we got there.
But also, the board has authority to toll as well as
right. So we would vest that. Okay.
I know we have co-authority, do we not, Mr. Chairman? I mean, we could do it or you could do it.
Well,
that's an interesting dilemma for us.
To the PPTA, the commissioner can do it. To do it on a primary road, you all have
the sole authority.
Yeah, through the PPTA, the Department of Transportation is a responsible public entity that is allowed.
What?
The Virginia Department of Transportation is a responsible public entity as defined in the UPTA law that is allowed to develop a feature.
Allowed to develop a what? At the end, as well.
The Public Private Transportation Act enables the Virginia Department of Transportation to enter into a comprehensive agreement that sets user fees for the use of transportation assets that have been procured pursuant to the UPTA.
And we, because I heard something a little differently, or I interpreted a little differently from what the chairman said.
The CTB has separate authority to set user fees for a variety of transportation assets in the Commonwealth. Most specifically, the way it's structured is general authority, and there's some specific authority for assets that use, for example, proceeds of our bond issuance. And that's laid out because so
Is there opportunity for conflict there? Or is it either or? You know, what if VDOT didn't want a toll and we did? You said no toll, commissioner said no toll, and CTB said, yeah, we want a 10-cent toll.
I think it's a practical matter that would be something that would have to be worked out among the board, leadership of what
in some area,
whenever you have co-authority or dual authority, you know what happens when you don't agree.
We, in this area, the guidance may be an invitation to struggle.
Yeah, I understand. That's a good way to put it.
And I would suggest that both the chairman, vice chairman, and the board member were reasonable representatives.
Yeah, I guess that gets to the makeup of the board, I guess, is what it gets down to.
They set it up. All right, some of the business terms, we talked about this financing through the 6320 Corporation. We'll have a debt service reserve account set up. The private sector will also have the opportunity to do a ramp-up reserve account utilizing some of the public dollars that are on there. We talked about operations and maintenance. VDOT will retain that responsibility. Tolling operations will go through the 6320 Corporation, but will be paid by VDOT. Comprehensive agreement will be a three-party agreement between the private partner, the 6320 Corporation, and the Department of Transportation. And as I said, the term is going to be no greater than 40 years.
really what the term is, depending on the financing structure that comes in from the private sector, it'll be tied to when the debt is paid.
But that was reduced from about 99 years we were looking at before?
Yes, sir. The structure that we had looked at before was a 99-year term. So the reason that we put this structure together was certainly some information from your office to try to reduce the number of years for this term. And again, after the term, it becomes the Department of Transportation can utilize it and see the revenues that come from it and get the benefit of the revenues and certainly bring it out for a PPTA or another project later on. So we want to try to reduce that as much as possible.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I've been trying to figure out exactly what the benefit of having a private partner in this project is. The state owns it, and VDOT's going to operate it, and yet we've got a private partner. And I'm curious, what are the advantages of having a private partner in this? Is it just to have somebody else take the heat for borrowing the money rather than have the Commonwealth do it?
Well, we certainly like that as part of it, but the private sector can bring anywhere between, we're estimating between $400 and $600 million to pay the project, bring private financing in, to bridge the amount and reduce the public subsidy that the department has to pay.
And they're willing to put up $400 million and not own the project and not operate it? I'm trying to figure out the incentive for that.
Well, the incentive really is in associated with the design-build aspect of the project. So you have a $1.5 billion design-build element of the project, and they're going to be able to see profit in there. They're going to be able to see profit in work that they're doing, putting the financing together. So that there are some areas where the private sector can see some profit.
Thank you. I wanted to follow up where Dr. Davis was, because your slide 3 lists the risks for the private sector, which is why this project is being considered in a different way. And I just wonder if the strength of the Public-Private Transportation Act is to actually take signals from the private sector about what makes good investment, then their conclusion that equity is risky here, that there is a free road that parallels it. I mean, why isn't that a similar signal to the public sector that this may not be the best way to go? And then finally, I understand why the Commonwealth, particularly given the current climate, might want to have a bigger say-so in the setting of tolls and particularly the escalation of tolls going forward. But as we found out, that carries its own set of risks. I mean, currently the climate about tolls is pretty negative. And I'm just wondering if we haven't missed a signal or two from the private sector, like if you're determined to go ahead, fine, but the normal private sector interest that we would bring to a project of this kind, we're actually going to limit our own risk and step back. I realize that this project also came forward in a different manner. You know, it wasn't really a proposal. It didn't fit a neat pattern. I mean, there's been I think maybe that probably some of that history would be useful to some of the newer members particularly. So I just wondered if you had further comments about that.
Well, it certainly is a different structure. The economics of the project make it a very tough project to advance, whether it be a P3 or whether it be a design bid build or a design build. And what we've tried to do really over the last 4 or 5 years and working with the private sector is try to identify a structure that meets the needs of not only the private sector, because they certainly want to be a part of this, but also the public sector. And meeting, obviously, this is the governor's top priority of the project, and we recognize that. Some of the other objectives of the project are creating an evacuation route, creating a route where economic development along the corridor can increase, creating access from the ports to the 460 corridor to distribution centers, access to the rail facilities along the 460 corridor to get to the Hartman corridor, a gateway to 295 and 85 and 95. So there are certainly ancillary reasons for us to advance this project. The economics, the structure that we put together, we think is the best form for the economics of the project itself. But you're right, there are other structures. The private sector has talked to us a lot about how much of a contribution we ought to make and the structure that they feel It's just over time we've tried to work on this structure to make this project move forward, and it may not be the best economical structure, but we think with the long-term view of the development of the project and the potential revenues that are generated for it, it's a positive.
Yeah. Well, but quickly, so the three, you expect to get three good offers in terms of financial packages later this year?
Yes, sir. Really, it's twofold. We think we're going to get positive responses from the investment grade revenue package or the financial package that we put together, but also from the design build side. They have very strong design build contractors on each of the teams. Mm-hmm. We think we're going to get very competitive estimates and for the design build aspect of the project.
And you know, I just conceptually, I just need just to put this in my framework about how to think about this. We have a certain amount of money, and we have to, we all recognize that there needs to be improvements to mobility, the east-west mobility, and the roads. We only have a certain amount of money. If we were to try and make improvements to 64, we're probably looking at close to $10 billion between adding a tube on either the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel or I think that unsolicited P3 on the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel was $5.5 billion. Then we're doing the looking at the widening just by one, maybe two lanes on 64 in the peninsula. That's probably going to come out to about $3 billion. Let's just say then we still have to make improvements on 64 and the lower views in front of the peninsula to deal with if we were to make improvements there. We don't have anywhere near the funds available to do either one of those projects. We have a project over here that's about $1.5 billion. We maybe have half, maybe a little bit more, whatever, to work out with the board and stuff. And the issue is, though, is that we don't want to build this thing where it's not an attractive nuisance, where we have the toll rates because of a traditional P3, first off, it's a greenfield, and right now the P3 community is very leery about doing greenfields, where you don't have any real data on traffic. And so they're going to demand much higher rates of return from us for their investment. And so then we have to step back and go, well, what that means then to get that higher rate of return, we're going to have much higher tolls, which then defeats the whole purpose of going forward with the project because people are not going to spend some of the number of tolls that they were talking about because they have 64 particularly to go up. So this is, they're come up with a creative way where we can essentially build at, create a four-lane interstate grade, 55-mile road for $1.5 million or so that fits Quantico generally in our budget, increases mobility, and we can keep the toll rates low enough that people will use it because they know for certain where they'll be circling. They don't have to worry about what's going to happen when they go on 64 in the peninsula, what's happening at the bridge tunnels, what's happening at 664. They know that they found there, pay $3 or so or something like that. And they have us defined trips. So that's generally why they're coming down to this. I mean, I keep on pointing out this thing, if we're going to do anything to Hampton Roads, right now this is the only way, given where our money is, that we can get something done that actually will make a difference.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
In terms of the private sector, were they sending signals and maybe we should step back? They were willing to invest in the project. They are willing to put equity in the project, but it's how much do they want for that? As the Secretary mentioned, the rates were up, but they also wanted an upside. They also wanted to share in the long-term revenue of the project. So if the revenue 20 years out was more than what I needed to pay the debt service, then they wanted a part of that, a share of that revenue. They also wanted a long term, beyond 40 years, in the 90-year range, an agreement. So they'd be sharing in that revenue for 40 years when your debt is already paid off. And my view was, if we are putting X amount of money into this game, then we should be taking, from the Commonwealth, take the benefit. That's why we structured the way that we did. So quite frankly, they did want to put some equity money in the game, but I just felt it cost me too much long term. So we went with the 6320 to look for more of the debt financing, the debt exempt financing, and we felt this was a better way that the Commonwealth could stay in control. Limit the term, 40 years. We control the toll rates, and we just thought that was a better way to do it.
Secretary. Dusty, my question is kind of a follow-up to Dr. Davis and Doug's. What are the principal bogeys here for the Commonwealth? If the 6320 moves forward, where's the downside to this? Is it the exposure of not generating the revenue and we have to make it up in the future? Is that the principal one? Or I just want to know. Yeah, we've heard all the plus sides, and I certainly support that and what the governor wants to do and support Hampton Roads, but I want to also know, it's our responsibility to know a downside to this and where's the exposure to the Commonwealth.
But from a financial perspective, the 6320 Corporation will take exposure for the tax-exempt bonds. I think the exposure for the department is if the revenues do not show up, then certainly we'll have the VTIP loan that is out there as a credit to us. We'll have the Commonwealth's contribution during the design build, part of the construction of the project. And I would suggest, hopefully, I would see the design build contract shifting risk of the design build over to the private sector itself. But we'll have risks associated with that. There's a risk sharing that will be a part of the right-of-way acquisition. 55 miles of right-of-way acquisition certainly has its risks associated with it. We have a risk-sharing regime in the contract itself, but the department, after an up and down of 10% within the allowance that we have, will take risk in part of that. So there are some risk elements of both the design build and of the financing, similar to what you would see on other P3 budgets.
Okay. Thank you, Dusty.
And I just want to point out, I know you're right about the 6320, I mean, unfortunately, because there is no recourse to us or the Commonwealth Board, the bond ratings will reflect that. I will point out that we have a 6320 on Pocahontas. And the issue is that we have the opportunity, once this thing is up and operating, to have a P3 on and run. The issue right now is getting over this hump on the construction costs.
But we did, you're right, the risk is in the revenue. That's your biggest risk long term. But we mitigated that risk by looking at the traffic environment study. And we only use a very conservative amount in terms of linking that to the debt. In other words, we didn't take 100% of that revenue and see what debt could be raised off of that. We took a conservative amount. So that mitigates somewhat the risk.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
How much money are we talking and when? Did we have $500 million kind of set aside in the governor's budget or plan for the transportation plan? Then how much more and where's the new money coming from and what are we looking at in total for us?
Well, we haven't. Well, first of all, raise a funny point when this project comes up. We haven't set any money aside. What we have is bond authority.
And
was
that
so
the $500 million?
Yeah, that's what's been set aside right now within the six-year plan. But the amount we have to put in will all depend on what the design, build, finance here is come back to.
Well, we think it's $1.5 to $2 billion project. Is that?
Well, it might be less than that. But again, we don't know what the numbers are. But you will have the opportunity when those numbers come back. This board will make a bond.
Will there be more bonds?
I don't have any.
What's that?
Will there be more bonds?
Yeah, that's whether the debt will be tax exempt versus the bonds. Yeah. That's that will determine the financial. Yeah.
So they're going to come back. I mean, what essentially is going to happen is this proposal is going to go to offer?
Three bidders, and they're going to come back and whatever has the best deal. We'll end up, essentially from that we'll determine how much we have to put in, and the court will have to put in, and then that will come be back before the board.
Yeah, we're estimating we'll be back in front of this board in the November time period to go through the full proposals that have been submitted.
Okay. I've got a hole here, Dusty, I need you to help me fill. The 6320 would be an entity that we would create. There's no recourse on the tax-exempt deck except to the 6320, which doesn't own anything other than the tolls, the tolling revenue. The VTIB is a credit enhancement loan to the 6320 with no recourse back to the state. Is the only way to get that loan paid back, or the only recourse tolling money?
Yes.
Okay. So
tolling revenue is the only funds that are going in besides the initial.
It's the only recourse.
That's
so if let's just use the worst case scenario, no car ever drives down it, so there's zero toll revenue. The 6320 goes into default on its tax exempt debt and its VTIB loan, and the people who bought the debt are out, and the VTIB is out, and you go forward.
That would be a very bad scenario.
Well, of course. I'm trying to use the worst one to just sort of get a ground zero.
The VTIB is a credit enhancement. In other words, under your scenario, if no car shows up in the first year, there's a debt service that has to be paid. There'll be a debt service coverage ratio that's first
get all
looked
that
into. Ramp up reserve that's put into. And
do they own the road in default? I mean, what do they get if the revenue is not does not cover the debt service?
Each of the reserves will first be put into to try to cover that debt. So
okay, and the reserves are created by what funding mechanism?
Well, the lenders will require both the debt service coverage ratio and the ramp up.
But in my illustration, we never had any revenue. So if your revenue is funding your reserve, that doesn't exist.
Yeah, if no revenue comes to the project, then the 6320.
So the reserves are built up within the tolling revenue stream. We're pulling some out for reserves. I'm assuming we're making our debt payments and so forth and
correct.
So on. Okay, so I get that. Now, the private partner, back to Dr. Davis's question, the private partner who's going to get this design-build contract, they're going to make us an offer, and we're going to say yes or no, and in their offer they're going to say, I'm going to build this road to these standards for $1.5 billion, okay, and we're going to pay them $1.5 billion to do that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
A combination of the financing brought by the private sector and the public contribution.
Where is the financing brought by the private sector? Is that the 6320 debt?
Yeah, that is the, if you look at the, going back to your,
that's where I am.
The tax exempt debt.
And with the credit enhancement behind it.
That's correct.
Okay, so that comes in to pay the contractor.
Pay the contractor.
And what else? You said it was a combination of the.
But the 6320 Corporation will also be paying for the tolling operations. But they're going to be a pass-through. The Department of Transportation will pay for the tolling.
And would the design-build contractor run the tolling operations? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, I don't think the design-build contractor will not run the tolling.
Okay, so we're going to pay.
There will be a entity that is procured to run the
tolling.
That's fine.
So that's a separate beast.
Right.
That will basically outsource the tolling operation to somebody to pay them a fee to collect it.
Right.
So the design build guy, let's say it's $1.5 billion, we fund it with a tax exempt debt and the VTIB enhancement, and I presume that raises the tax exempt debt is $1.5 billion to pay the contractor.
That raises enough to pay for the design build construction.
This is where I broke down.
Plus the reserve.
Here's where I broke down. Okay, so we got the contractor who built the road. We paid them the money. Their risk is they got to deliver the project for the amount of money that they said, given the specs we gave them, and so forth and so on. Then there was some mention, either by the secretary or somebody, that they could have as much as $400 to $600 million in the deal.
That's the tax-exempt debt.
The tax-exempt debt isn't the design-build contractor's issue, is it? It's the 6320's issue.
That's correct. It's the 6320 corporation issue for the tax-exempt debt. But that's the $400 to $600 million is the tax-exempt debt that the private sector is bringing into the 6320 corporation.
So are you telling me that that in this chart, the design build contract slash offeror, what's the relationship to the tax exempt debt? There is none in this chart.
I would see, and certainly the commissioner can clarify this, but I would see the private sector's financing people being financial advisors.
Talk about the design build contractor, because it can be different private sectors. Meaning, I'm looking at the contractor that's going to build the road. The three that you listed here, and they're going to make us an offer. Are they bringing debt?
They are bringing.
Or equity?
No, they're not bringing any equity.
There's no equity.
There's no equity.
Are they going and securing debt?
They're going out and securing commitments for debt, and those debt will be transferred over to 6320 Corporation. So I would see the private sector being as much as a financial advisor bringing in the debt for the 6320 Corporation and also the design build company.
And so they're going to have to be compensated for that activity, not just the building, but the going and identifying the debt, securing the debt, transferring the tax-exempt debt, if you will, to the 6320.
And that would be all in the cost, the upfront cost that they provide to the department as the lowest public sector.
Okay. So let's say that's $1.5 billion, back to the model.
Okay.
You suggested that the debt piece, what I heard, that they would raise and transfer is $600 million.
We've estimated between $400 and $600 million.
Okay, pick six because that's the better number in the illustration. So it's $600 million that they're going to go secure and dump into the 6320, which functionally is going to pay back to them, but it costs $1.5 billion. So there's $900 million that we haven't paid for yet. Okay, we haven't given to the design build people yet.
Using your calculation, yes, sir.
Right. So where does that come from?
That would be public sector. The only two things that come in here are tax exempt debt and public sector.
So we put the public. So in this illustration, we'd have to inject $900 million. I presume that's paid during the contract period, not over some.
It's paid. Yeah, it's paid over a 7-year period.
The build period.
That's
right. Okay. So functionally, what we're doing is we're creating an entity that will hold some debt, non-recourse to the rest of us. We're getting a contractor and their team to build it and go find the $600 million in debt and transfer it over to the entity. Then we throw in $900 million, and we control the rest of it going forward. Okay. So, I presume when you were talking about the toll revenue that was coming through in your illustration, I think you used $14 million and $18 million and $20 million. What tolling rate and what volume were you using to get to those numbers?
We're looking at a tolling rate of anywhere between 7 cents to 10 cents per mile.
So it's 55 miles. Let's get it on the. Okay, well, it's going to be. So is it dependent on the exit you get off? It's variable depending on the exit you get off?
The distance that you go. It'll be a closed system, so there'll be gantries at each of the exits.
Okay. So if you went the whole way, $5.50 on the 10 cent mile. It's 55 miles. Is this a interstate, is this a 65 mile an hour highway in our view?
Yes, it is. Yep. 4-lane divided to freeway or interstate standards.
Okay. So you're thinking that given this model, we can do it for 10 cents a mile?
We think we can do it between 7 to 10 cents a mile.
Well, I'm giving you an out.
Okay, we'll do the 10.
I mean, pick the 10 and everything you do better, you're in.
It'll do better for the project, certainly.
Okay, last question. The non-tolling O&M TAMS contract, is that another private sector partner?
Yes, that'll be competitively bid by the Virginia Department of Transportation separately.
So in theory, we could have three private sector partners, the one who builds it and secures the financing, the one who runs the tolling operations, and the one who does the O&M.
Yes, sir.
So Mr. Chairman, the TAMS, the maintenance piece, is like any other contract that we do now to maintain interstate roads. So I wouldn't classify them as a partner on this project.
They're a vendor.
Yes.
Well, same with the tolling operations in a sense. They're just a vendor.
Right.
So the risk, back to my illustration, or my earlier question, the risk that the design-build partner has is that they got to bring the contract in on budget, on time. They have to provide the debt at whatever level was in the agreement, I presume. If they don't get the debt at whatever number that is, then the amount and the rate, is that risk on them or is that risk on back on us?
Well, to have a compliant proposal, they will have to bring the committed debt.
The committed debt to the proposal.
At an investment grade rating.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Rich?
I'm just a little confused. You told Shep we have to come up with $900 million, right?
Through his calculation.
Where exactly does the money come from? Is it strictly from the infrastructure bank loan? Don't we have some sitting in the mega project and the six-year plan? Can you clarify?
Where's the 900 coming from? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I'm asking. Where's the 900 or the 800 or whatever coming from?
Well, the illustration I used was 900. So where's that
come
from?
That
are we all divvying that up here?
Just use your example, all right? You made that come up with those numbers.
Yeah.
All
right. Well, use whatever number.
Whatever the number is.
X number of these is largely from Garvey. And the contribution from the port.
That's fine.
Yeah, there's a $250 million contribution from
whatever that number is.
From port. Whatever the number is, I don't care if it's $500 million, $300 million, or $900 million. It's basically going to be garbage. So the whole thing will basically be borrowed money, whether it's taxes and debt brought by the private partner into the 6320, or whether it's whatever our contribution has to be. Our contribution will come through Garvey bond debt.
There's more than just the loan, though, right? We've got the Garvey money coming and sitting in the mega project fund. Right, in addition to the loan from the bank, is that right?
Right, the VTIP loan will only be used as a credit enhancement, $8 million credit enhancement. So, but yes, the most of it, the public contribution, will be coming from Garvey's, from the main program.
And you have here, we're going to vote on the VTIP loan in June?
Right.
Really? I thought we wouldn't come before us until November.
But we'll put an application in for the VTIP loan. We'll seek your permission in June to move forward with the VTIP loan so that we have that credit enhancement in place as we move forward with the private sector.
Okay. Now, I guess the local skin in the game is the port. Because, in Northern Virginia, we're asking the counties to pay for Dulles Airport. And, around 28, we had the taxpayers and the localities paying the Tysons Corner people. Are there any businesses along this route that are contributing to this, or is the local skin in the game is the board, essentially?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Keene, and then we have Dusty. Given the fact that we've got corridor improvements along that route with the passenger rail coming online and so forth, does the model give you any discomfort in the revenue predictors for the revenue on tolls to meet this debt and so forth? It seems to be a little bit fluid as we look at bringing that rail service online. It's going to take some cars off the road, obviously. I would imagine that the model is a little bit variable.
Certainly the timing of those improvements have been input into the model itself. We don't think it's going to have a significant impact. We see a large growth in the trucks, the heavy vehicles on the facility itself going to the distribution centers, and they won't be using the rail, the high-speed rail, the transit element of that. So we don't see a big hiccup associated with that. Certainly there will be a little bit of diversion off of the roadway associated with it, but we don't see it as a big
five,
Mr. Chairman, one quick question. Assuming that your modeling didn't suggest the Shep Miller scenario of zero traffic, what does it suggest 10 years out traffic levels?
From a revenue perspective?
Well, mm-hmm. No, from an actual traffic count.
I would say from 10 years out, it's probably going to be about 13 to 15,000 vehicles a day.
How many is that a year?
13, 15,000.
Well,
under our scenario, under a
financial model, we think on day one it's going to be about 8,100 vehicles a day.
So you're discounting off the current, it's about right. 10,000 now on
existing on 460, there's about 11,500.
Right,
about 460.
Yeah.
So we are discounting the use of the free alternative.
Mr. Chairman, just one last question. Do you have a sense of, forget the trucks, I mean, let me ask two questions. How much of this do you think in the short term is commercial traffic, meaning truck traffic that's sort of going through, versus automobile traffic? And presume the rates are going to be, the $550 for the whole trip is probably for a car, not a truck, or is it the same?
No, that's for a car. A truck would be
three times? So the difference in time for the trip, for the length, versus the alternative next to it. The alternative is 55 miles an hour for 80% of the trip, and it's 30 miles an hour for 20% of the trip. What's the time savings? For, you know, not calculating accidents and all that, but just regular throughput.
We think that there's going to be about 15 to 20 minutes time saving utilizing the new facilities.
Thank you.
Over 55 miles.
Over 55 miles.
Oh, yeah, the whole route.
As predictability.
And it gives you an alternative, and it gives you more throughput, and. And it gives you economic development opportunity.
And it runs through, let's just lay out the other issue here, and that is it will run through two megatons.
Two what?
Two megatons. We have right now dialed the length, and that's 1,800 acres under their control. Norfolk Southern has 1,500 acres under their control that are bisected by the rail and will be bisected by this road. They will be the only true megasites we have in the chain that have will have road.
Mr. Secretary, is there a way once these mega centers get going that they can help pay for this?
I'm sorry?
Is there a way once we get this thing going that the mega centers can help finance?
Well, that's one of the reasons we asked in this General Assembly session for the ability at the state level to do national equipment financing.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons we asked for it, so that as you build out this road and others that are having a direct economic development impact, put them to the next generation from there and help pay for it. The General Assembly recognized that.
Yeah, despite my earlier questions, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to make a positive comment. Number one, I'm very encouraged. I'm very encouraged that the leadership of VDOT and your leadership, but also VDOT, has become much more entrepreneurial, much more sophisticated in the last 5 years. I mean, we would not have been even talking about this type of structure then at all. And I think this is what our times requires. The sophistication, the flexibility to do deals that are possible. You made a very good point, Mr. Secretary, which I wanted to second. Positively or negatively, we're going to be building from this point on what we can afford, and we need these type of instruments that are slightly different to be able to do that. But we also need to be very honest. I mean, these sophisticated structures are necessary to accommodate the limits on state cash and state borrowing capacity. And so we are doing something that extends our reach a little bit further than we traditionally have thought about it. And it's going to be up to us to make good decisions very early in these processes to make sure we don't get ourselves out on limbs. In this case, I think the question today has helped me understand this a lot better. And I want to be encouraging to this particular process, but also the larger process of being smart, sophisticated, and flexible as we go forward.
And after this presentation, before this comes back in June, I'll ask, you know, I want to see if you can reach out to all the board members, either go see them or talk to them on the phone, and walk if there are any questions.
Yes, sir.
This is, Ms. Gomez, you know, you're right on. I mean, we are doing, going to have to do things. We've gone past the issue of just simply we have, you know, page ago on building capital projects, given them where the revenue streams are, and we have to figure out ways to get done what we have done and how we get done. Mr. Keith?
Yes. Is there a 5% borrowing limit for roads, and does this not count against that because of the 6320?
That's exactly right. So by the 6320, it's not the debt of cost.
Sorry. Well, Dusty, what do you anticipate the rate would be on the loan or on the debt?
On the taxes due debt?
Given it's non-recourse, it's all falling revenue, so there's, you know, there's risk in that.
I would hate to speculate on the markets with all the different parameters that are part of it, but I would say sort of anywhere between 4-5% on the tax exempt.
Well, obviously that's factored into what we think the project's going to cost and what we think the toll would have to be, and, you know, so 4-5%. And it would be debt for how, what period of time?
Well, that'll be a part of the financial package that comes back, but no greater than 4 years.
And I'll just point out the Midtown Tunnel caps. That was triple B minus bonds, and we got a 4.5-3 minus 5.5.
5.5. Thank you.
All right, so.
We've got a lot more thinking, I guess.
Sorry, we'll be coming back to this group in June. Beach Head Loan, we talked a lot about it, $8 million line of credit. My office will be submitting the application for it. I will be working with Department of Transportation, VRA, and VTIP advisory panel to complete the process and come back to you in June to ask for your support and action beyond that support. Key milestones associated with public outreach. Certainly, we made some commitments to the General Assembly where we want to be as transparent as possible. Request for detailed proposals, addendum will go out on May 25th. Prior to that, we'll be doing some public notice and targeted outreach to the GA members. Today's CTB presentation. Moving forward with selection offers, we'll be back here in front of this board, making sure that you know what the major business points and what the proposals came in on. And certainly execution of the contract, we'll put public notice out. And make sure that the comprehensive agreement and all the other documents are available to the public. These are just the next steps. June formation of the 6320 Corporation and the VTIP loan in front of this group. September, the offerors submit their detailed proposals. We go through an evaluation and selection process. We come back in November to this body to talk about the major business points. Go to commercial financial close in the December time period. Construction begins 2013. And construction completed five years later. Tolling begins at that same time period. And with that, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I was just curious. The 6320 code section, is that what they call it?
Yes, IRS code section. I was
trying to figure what the match was and why they didn't add up to 100.
Mr. Chairman, does this project include 58 getting out of the port? It doesn't pick that up, does it?
It does not. The scope of this project starts right at 58 in Suffolk and goes to here.
So we may have to come back and deal with that.
I think that certainly is a potential project that we should look at.
Okay. And I think all terminus information is that.
Right.
Okay, 95.
Anybody seen this slide before? It's the same scope as we've talked about in the past. It's a 9-mile extension, 14 miles of expanding existing HOV, 6 miles of operational improvements on 95, and certainly some access improvements. Now let's slide that we've seen before, concessionaire party consistent with the 495 is Fluor Transurban, joint venture is Fluor Lane. The term of this project will be 3 years of construction and 73 years operating period, and the reason that we did that, we wanted to make it coterminous with the 495 project. The design build cost will be fixed price, fixed date. Design build cost were anticipated and then negotiated an amount of $620 million. Some of the major things that have occurred since Chief Deputy Kilpatrick was here in the December time period, giving these major business points, or finalizing the elements of the comprehensive agreement. FTU has gotten underwriters and gone out for the credit rating process with the draft version of the comprehensive agreement. In December, we received a Tiger grant of $20 million, which equates to about $140 to $160 million tip fee. We were just recently, April 24th, granted the ability to submit an application for a TIFIA loan. We've combined those two processes. We've been working with USDOT and the TIFIA office to combine those two processes to create a $300 million loan that will come through the TIFIA office itself. We just recently received notification from USDOT that we do have access and allocations of the private activity bonds, about $450 million. So that's positive towards the financing of the project. And we're working with FHWA on the tolling agreement submitted back in February. It's at their headquarters right now. Talking a little bit about the funding itself, the project, we're looking to close in the July time period for a commercial financial close, but the TIFIA loan, because of the process that it has to go through, will not close until the October time period. So there's a delta between the financial close and what we call a refinancing of the TIFIA, or getting the TIFIA dollars in. FTU is expected to raise $656 million in private funds, including $293 million in equity. That $656 million will raise to about $840 million when the TIFIA loan goes full. Right now, with our contribution is $92 million. Due to the TIFIA delay, at the financial close in July, there's going to be a commitment of equity, additional equity of $117 million, and Commonwealth is $83 million. We hope to never use those dollars because we feel confident that the TIFIA is going to come in the October time period. Those commitments need to be in place just in case TIFIA doesn't come about. But like I said, we're very confident that TIFIA is going to come in the October time period, and the way that we structured the financing of the project, those dollars will not be used until later in the construction process so that we can make sure TIFIA is in place.
One more question. We think that we will use zero of that then, right?
Well, we will use the $92 million, which is an upfront contribution.
Right.
But we do not believe that we'll need to use the $183 million. We will need to commit it to the project to go to financial.
But we won't use the sound of it.
But we, if the TIFIA comes in, which we're very confident about, we will not utilize the commitment.
If it doesn't, we will. If it didn't happen, that's what it's for.
If it does not come in, then we will have to fund the $183 million.
Do we have that to reserve? Is that in the mega project fund?
Yeah.
Well, I have to pay additional carbon. We'll have these carbon. So we'll need.
And that comes out of the world of all the other projects, right? He said there's a 6-year plan.
The carbies generally we're using them for the large projects.
Right.
And this would be whether it's one of the large projects. Right now, the $92 million would be for already carbies.
Yes.
So the issue is right now we're committed to this project. So if they get tipped in, get TIFIA, where our commitment is only $92 million. If they don't get TIFIA, then we're looking at essentially all told about $280 million.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Two questions. You told us that the basically the $183 million is the offset until we get the TIFIA, but there's a $33 million difference between the TIFIA application in 183, so 150 versus 183.
So the TIFIA will be 300. It's a combination of the grant that we received and the TIFIA itself. So the TIFIA will be 300.
Okay. Second thing, and this is more generic, I remember when we were talking about tolling on 95 and 81, and we sort of looked at 81 and said, we can't ask for both at the same time, or, you know, they didn't want us to ask for both at the same time. So we were looking at one versus the other. How does this sort of project impact that ability to look for? Does it have any impact on that?
No. So we're still moving forward on the 95 tolling project. But we made it clear that the tolling for 95 would be to the south of. So the 95 express lanes run right now from Springfield to Massaponics,
right,
mile mark 126. So the tolling, or straight tolling, or without the express lanes, is from miles post 0 to 126. But we have asked for, and it's obviously still working with the Federal Highway Administration, that even if we collect tolls south of 126, to allow us to potentially use those funds for improvements north of 126. Since it's most likely people driving north of 126 are also going to end up potentially going south.
And if we wanted to, ultimately, to look at a toll on 81, when would we be allowed under the sort of the regulations or the guidelines to look at that, since we're sort of not allowed to look at two at the same time?
So you have two hurdles. The first is there is this pilot program that for the 95 tolling, which allows only one interstate. Three states and one interstate. So it's three different states can apply for it and three different interstates. Each one of those, so you get each one state per interstate.
Right.
The other challenge we have is on 81, there is a General Assembly has passed the law when the STAR Solutions project was proposed that essentially said that the General Assembly specifically had to pass any sort of tolling on 81. So
right now we're working the 95 project under the pilot, and there's only three states, and each state can do one interstate. So unless they do another pilot or come back with some other program, there is nothing to look at 81, and there's a restriction by the Assembly. Got it. Thank you.
But you could do 81 under other federal programs. So there are other federal programs, such as that allow you to do a different pricing to expansion, pay for expansions, and things like that, which is separate authorities, separate programs.
Thank you.
Chairman, just the last two slides. We always like to talk about the benefits of the project. Certainly the 95 project is going to add capacity to manage congestion along the corridor, expand the connectivity of the HOV corridor with the 495 Express, I-66, Dulles Toll Road, fix that major bottleneck at Dumfries with the 9-mile extension, working with Director Drake, bring the transit component to the corridor itself, and obviously significant job creation. Next steps, we're going to finalize comprehensive agreement and the exhibits pretty soon. The ongoing early works, which I came to this board with last month about, is moving forward. Complete FWA review this spring. We talked about the July commercial and financial close, concurrent closes. Start construction in the August time period. Complete construction in 2015 and begin the tolling of the corridor of the 95 Express Lane in 2015. Is that any questions?
So basically, just want to make sure we're going to be asking to be able to go to early close. Normally we wait for the TIFIA. We'll lose the construction cycle. And also we would have the potential to lose the design build criteria that was submitted. So what we'd like to do is go to early close. We have already reached out to Federal Highway. They're okay with this approach. And so we close in July. We'll see them out there starting construction almost immediately on the extension of the HOV lanes past the Dumfries.
From a design build cost cost perspective, we think we're saving anywhere between $38 to $60 million getting this thing done and getting this construction season. It just started in this construction season.
Mr. Chairman, so in the 6-year plan, then we're going to have to reserve $183 million for this, correct? Is that what you're going to be asking us to do?
Well, we have not really programmed in the garden sales.
Mr. Secretary, I get you to talk closer to your microphone. That's hard.
So the Garveys, again, you don't, we have not programmed into the 6-year plan the Garvey sales.
Not yet.
I mean, once we commit to the project, then we then go ahead and put it in. But right now, I mean, we have authority for $1.2 billion in Garvey sales, and we've done around $400 million for Midtown Tunnel project. Will be $100 million for the for 95 express lanes, and then we still have authority for another $700 million or thereabouts.
And that's kind of, you find that in the Megaton section?
Again, they're just penciling. There's really, quote unquote, really not a Megaton. It's just simply a Garvey authority.
So then what are we doing with that fund? We have that mega fund line item. Is it going to be reflected in there?
No. It's not a fund. It's just your authority.
Right.
We call it that, but it's just, if you sold bonds, you would have that amount of money. Because it's based on the bond, the ability to sell bonds.
But all that's reflected in that one line item, right?
Because it's not money. Not real
money. Yeah, I know it's reflected something, but I just want to find out where it's being reflected. Where do I find it?
400 went to Midtown. Yeah. Right now, 100 for this. So then you will still have approximately $700 million in authority for to sell Garvey bonds, of which some of it's 460. And everything depends on, you know, the sales and what the projects are.
It's not in the 6-year plan until we put it, until we borrow it and put it in there.
It's a draft that we're looking at now, so I'm trying to find it.
It's just bond capacity.
But we use Garvey bonds for other things other than these mega projects, right?
No, we have not. Garveys are specific onto all projects. So we sell the bonds, it says this is Garvey money. That were sold for specifically Midtown Tunnel.
But you're saying we're only using for larger projects and not for other major projects?
Yeah, we have not used the Garveys. Brands, they've used brands for those, but we no longer have authority to do brands. Garveys are project specific. Although something happens with projects, there is latitude and they allow you to move it on to another federally authorized project. Has to be a federal project, and it is specific to that project. That's why we just generally, just for a sleight of hand, easy use call, that's the mega project.
But all of our construction projects now are federal, right?
No, actually, you know, obviously with the 3202 bonds, we have state projects that are state bonds.
I mean the bulk of this one.
Yes, that's correct.
All right.
Okay. Steve.
On these Garveys, once we use them, how often, how quickly do they regenerate? Is there any concern that we're, you know, putting all our Garveys in right now? I know that's kind of, we wanted to get the money out on the street, but once we've got it out on the street, how quick before we get them back and can use them again down the road?
They're 15 years. They're generally 15-year bonds.
And how much do we have?
After 95, after Midtown, we'll have around $700 million in authority.
And then once we, and that's not in counting the approximate $500 we may use or whatever on 460.
Right, so then you're down to $200 million.
And then it's going to take us 10 to 15 years before we've got Garveys to use?
That's right.
Is there any concern that we're using all our Garveys this fast, or is that the whole
thing? Rather build now and build later.
Yeah,
interest rates low.
Yeah, I got to tell you, we sold the Garveys for 3%.
Yes.
3%,
and the prices we're getting, as you saw with the 29 bypass, are exceptional.
So we want to get them out there as fast as we can.
The issue is to get as many projects moving now. Because you think about it, just look at the 460, any of these projects take 4 to 5 years. Sell the bonds now, you're looking at, you know, by the time they're done, you've already been planning on the next big mega projects.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, is there any chance we could lobby a little bit for an 81 project for a couple hundred million of those Garvey funds at some point? Is that out of the question?
No. In fact, I've been trying to pencil in how do we do an 81 project.
I'd really love to see some effort to start at least on a portion of that, because it's just going to be harder and harder to do. Every time I drive down it, I think, how in the world are we going to do construction when you have as much traffic as you have on it, you know? And that's just going to get harder and harder. So I would certainly urge you to take every look to see what sort of project we could start, even if it's in the 100 to 200 million range. It would be a huge benefit.
Yeah, and this is something we've been leading to, because, and that's why we've kind of taken control of this 81 coalition.
Yeah.
And started these outreach efforts. And as you know, it's difficult to get consensus out here also.
Yes.
As to, I mean, it really is going to involve having to add lanes.
It is.
Unfortunately, there does seem to be a great deal of opposition to that.
There appears to be, Mr. Chairman, a fairly strong consensus on adding a lane on each side. There are people who are opposed to that in certain portions of the run, but that appears to be the one area where there is consensus on the project. And we had a little bit of opposition to the climbing lanes in one jurisdiction, but when we suggested we'd move it to another jurisdiction, they went away very quickly. And I think it could be managed to have a project that would add the third lane on a significant run of the road of 81, particularly in areas of high congestion. That would be a good project.
Very much agree. I mean, this is why we also trying to do as much out in different parts of the state.
Mr. Chairman, one of the areas of discussion today would be that overlap of 77 81 is going to be a prime area that we need to look at for some immediate relief that can be a major improvement from particularly 77 North meeting I-81. And I believe there's some plans in the works to make some adjustments there now, but that entire overlap, 8 miles, is a prime example of the area that needs that attention. So we'll be addressing that later.
In fact, I speak with Mr. Russell about that, about trying to identify sub-parts of that project.
Thank you.
Mr.
Carson? One last question for Dusty. Is the TIFIA funding tied up just in process, or is that a part of the highway bill that doesn't exist?
Process.
Just the process.
It's process. It's getting the underwriters, getting the credit rating, going through the process.
Thank you.
And basically what's happened particularly is now OMB. So we deal with and work with Federal Highway, Department of Transportation, the Innovative Office, Financing Office. They have all their own rules, and then they have to go deal with OMB, and they end up, since it is a credit, it is a loan, it takes some time.
Yes?
Just a general comment, Mr. Chairman. Back to what Mr. Poulmay was saying, others here, I do applaud us. We are much more entrepreneurial. We are making lots of headway. But I hope it doesn't mask the fact, to some of the outside people looking at all that we're doing, that we're still out of money. I mean, and I've heard this criticism from other members, well, you didn't give any money, but look what you're doing. And I just would like to, just in the vein, to say, yes, we're doing this, but these are, you know, great we've got this efficient and we should continue to do this, but it's not the answer down the line. We've got to have additional revenue. So I'd just like to have that known. If there's anything else this board can do other than what we're doing, let people know, yes, we're making lemonade out of lemons, but it's still a long ways from what
we're not
going to
have many lemons.
We're going to have any lemons left here pretty soon. So I just would like to, for our public to know that we get it, and we're good stewards of the money, but the money's fast going away.
All right. Mr. Lawson.
Can you tell us about Easy Pass?
Good morning, members of the board. It's been a few months since I've talked to you about BTIP, so I thought it'd be a good time to kind of give you a status update and just talk a little more about some of the BTIP upcomings that you heard already heard about this morning. Just kind of in brief and to catch everybody back up, the Infrastructure Bank was created by the 2011 General Assembly session by Chapters 830 and 868. It is a non-reverting fund, revolving loan fund within the Transportation Trust Fund. And being non-reverting, that just means that whatever balances remain at the end of the year do return or we stay with the funds and are able to use in the following year. The VTIP was initially capitalized with about $283 million, a mixture of about $33 million of general funds from surplus and about $250 million in funds from the Commonwealth Transportation Fund. The program is administered in terms of policy and programmatic aspects by yourself, the CTB, and VRA serves as the financial advisor. The program guidance was approved by yourself in September, and we began accepting applications shortly thereafter. As you recall, the first loan application received was for the Dominion Boulevard project in the city of Chesapeake. And that project is a 3.8-mile improvement from Cedar Road to Great Bridge Boulevard, which includes the replacement of an existing two-lane drawbridge with a four-lane fixed span. The request was for a $152 million loan for a total project value of about $412
million. Mr. Commissioner, can I go back just for one quick second? So $250 million came from a six-year plan, essentially, that could have been used for other projects on the primary or whatever, right?
They were funds that were identified through the audit process that we put toward the bank.
Those are funds that are not available for other projects in our districts.
Correct.
Thank
you. The project will be done as a toll road. The city will include plans to issue or create a Chesapeake transportation system that will include Dominion Boulevard as well as the existing Chesapeake Expressway. And they will sell about $230 million in toll revenue bonds to support the project. The VTIP monies will kind of fill the funding gap between the toll revenue bonds that they'll be issuing and the six-year improvement monies that have been provided to the project. The loan, what you approved the loan in January, and it was an interest rate of about 3.3%. We are continuing to work with the city. The city has retained all of their approvals through City Council, and we are looking to go to actually close the loan this fall. Our second application was received in January by the IDA of Loudoun County. The original loan request was for a $60 million loan with an interest subsidy for a project. It was a collaborative effort. I guess the application today was a collaboration between Kincora, Dulles Real Estate and Investor LLC, and the IDA. Kincora is an early stage 400-acre mixed-use development located in the southeast quadrant of the intersection of Route 7 and Route 28. A community development authority was proposed to collect a special assessment on multifamily residential units to repay the loan. After some review and discussion with VRA, a revised application was submitted in February requesting a loan for $80 million. This $80 million loan would be repaid by special assessments on both residential and non-residential property. This map, how many of you are familiar with the area, but it's a little small, but right there kind of in the center you see the dark green that represents the Concord development. As mentioned, as part of this agreement, the proffer agreement with Loudoun County, the developer is required to construct a four-lane extension of Pacific Boulevard, connect to Russell Branch Parkway, and to extend Gloucester Parkway from the intersections of Notes and Pacific. Following a standard build-out, development build-out, this process would probably take 10 to 15 years to actually build these road improvements. The project would be done really in kind of in three phases. It would be funded by the VTEB loan. Phase one is about 5,900-foot extension of Pacific Boulevard north towards from its extension from its point at Gloucester Parkway. Phase two is about a 3,600-foot extension of Gloucester Parkway west from its intersection with Pacific Boulevard to Loudoun County Parkway. And phase three is a 2,300-foot extension of Pacific Boulevard north at its existing terminus to Russell Branch Parkway and a 1,700-foot extension south to Severn Way.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
Ms. Lawson. I'm trying to correlate the names with the numbers that are on the map because I don't find the names.
Okay.
Go back to the map, the previous
one. Well, this one actually shows the segments.
Okay. Go.
That helps.
Next, the next slide. I can't see that either.
So.
That's like.
All right. Well, so that can help you at least by color.
If you go back to the first map.
Yes.
And you show the project area.
Correct.
Are any of these roads on here the ones you're talking about in the next slide? Gloucester Parkway, Pacific Boulevard? Or are they internal and we can't see them on this map?
The 607 you see, if I'm correct, is Loudoun County Parkway.
Okay.
And the others are smaller and you can't see
okay.
them.
Okay, we'll just continue. I can't see them.
Okay.
Can you see them? Anybody see them?
This map.
You can see 607 goes kind of right down the middle. And so its connection is two.
It's not, you know, it's not. I can look at them later.
It's 607 that you saw on the other map.
Right.
So this green here is phase one to
Pacific Boulevard.
Right here. Then phase two is the Gloucester extension, which you see completes the third roof area here. This blue is what will be added.
Gotcha.
And then the red section. Two red sections on the third
phase. Are those totally new, the red ones, or are they improvements?
This is just new.
Okay, thank you.
We have members here from Pecora and Loudoun County both that can answer more detailed questions if necessary. Just a little bit about the project. The project is a local transportation priority, and it will serve to reduce some congestion or severe congestion on Route 7, Route 28, and Waxpool Road. In addition, the project provides a strong potential for economic development within the area. The three phases of the project could not be built in the near future without innovative financing, such as what can be provided by the Infrastructure Bank. County has competing debt finance infrastructure needs at this time and doesn't have the capacity to put toward the project. The VTIB loan assistance for this project would be 100% financing for the project. We have had district staff look at the project and look at the construction schedule and believe both to be reasonable and achievable. Phase one has all of its approvals and permits in place and is ready to move to construction. Phase two is scheduled for construction to begin in March of 2013. Has all the design work is currently underway and the right-of-way and permits need to be obtained. Phase three is a little further out with design still needed to be completed as well as the right-of-way and permits obtained. Current schedule would have the one segment, the Pacific to Southern Way, beginning construction in September of 13, with the upper of the northern segment beginning construction in December of 13. We are continuing to move forward with the application review and with CONCOR. A draft term sheet was provided to Concora on May the 9th. They are reviewing it now, and we are planning follow-up meetings within the next week or two to finalize the terms with the RA. Once that is done, we are looking to have the detailed advisory panel to meet to consider the application, and we are on, have plans to have this completed in order to present this application to you in at the June meeting for your possible action based on the recommendations of the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you talk about the interest subsidy, can you sort of flesh that out a little bit for us? Should we bind down that interest rate through this process? Or
the original application is back to the
core. Well, yeah, you talked about it a couple times in the presentation.
When we refer to an interest subsidy with the DTIP, if you recall in the guidelines, it says the methodology for determining the interest rate, which is tied to MMD. And what
it's tied to what?
The municipal market data.
Right.
The interest exchange.
Right.
Published data. And when we looked at these loans, if they request a loan that is below that base rate would be considered a subsidized interest. The original Dominion loan, they had sought a subsidized rate of 3%. After we went through the negotiation, they actually paid what we saw to be the standard rate of 3.3, which fit our criteria. The original loan for Concora.
So by using that terminology, you're really telling us that it's a below market. It's just a below market interest rate that we're providing, or that they're asking for.
That's correct.
Thank you,
Mr. Secretary.
Yes.
I think I'm going to have some serious issues with this. But the first loan we did, Transportation Infrastructure Bank, is what I thought we were doing to help out communities, localities who needed help with their roads, their construction projects. They needed to borrow the money to help out their particular transportation issues. The first project we did, $152 million City of Chesapeake, is a road and a bridge, redoing a bridge owned by the City of Chesapeake. And we gave them the money to help finance that, their road, their street. It looks like what we're doing here is giving an $80 million loan to a private company to create a subdivision. And that, to me, is not what the BTIP was intended to do. It was to give it to localities who didn't have money, and because we're not giving them money, to do construction projects. And this is going to Concora to build a mixed-use residential development. Is that who the loan's going to? It's going to an IDA, but it's going to a private company who's going to profit on this. And what is the purpose of VTIP under our guidelines?
The purpose of VTIP under the purpose of VTIP under loan under the law is to provide loans to projects to advance them, where we're going to get paid back and create revenue streams and then be able to invest in other projects. So when this was created, we had in mind things like Dominion Boulevard, which is a state. I mean, we own 17. But they are managing this project for us. And so we're giving them a low interest loan, which enables them to complete their financing and to keep the rates.
I mean, that seems like what we're supposed to be doing. Yeah, City of Chesapeake building a state road, and their bridge seems perfectly what we were trying to do. The Concora giving the loan to the private developer to build a subdivision doesn't, to me, seem like what VTIP is intended to do.
Chair, I'll come to you, Mr. Rich, in a moment. In the counties, how most of the road transportation infrastructure is built is the developers provide the proffers to the to build these things. Now, the situation here is that the developer is still years off from building this infrastructure. And so the county, Loudoun County, is
IDA.
It's a Loudoun County who wants this, because if you could just go back to your slides, and I'm going to ask Mr. York and Mr. Scott if they want to come up here, but right there, this project is sort of interesting because of the traffic counts that were involved here. I mean, right now, that intersection of Route 7 and Route 28 are extremely, very, very high volume areas. It is major commercial areas, and when we build out the connection between Gloucester and Route 28, what's the traffic count on that? It was something like 40-something thousand cars a day. Could you say that? This is the chairman of the Board of Supervisors in Loudoun County.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mr. Peake, the difficulty that we're having right now is Waxpool Road is carrying about 45,000 daily trips. Part of that is because we have a $4.80 toll rate on the Greenway, and people are diverting from using that and going up north to Gloucester to come back south down to the toll road. So when a developer came in, the Board of Supervisors, when they approved it, decided to forego the proffers for capital improvements such as schools and fire and rescue centers and asked that it be all used for the transportation network in here. So we had, I think the contribution, Mr. Scott, was around $32 million in proffer. The challenge that we have is that we need improvement to Waxpool Road yesterday. This segment that is being proposed for Gloucester will reduce about 10,000 daily trips off of Waxpool. Gives us what is only our second connection from Route 28 into the Ashburn area in between Route 7 and the airport, which is south on Route 28. And, of course, Pacific will also provide a great deal of relief and give a connection for those folks that may be north on Ashburn to go up and around. This particular project includes two bridges that go over the Broad Run, one in Gloucester and the other Russell Branch as Pacific curves up and around. If we don't take advantage of the infrastructure bank, we're talking, I don't know, 10 years to 12 years before we get this improvement. And we just simply can't wait any longer because of the growth. And so what the board had asked the Kincora folks to do is to apply for use of the infrastructure bank so that we could get the money up front and the infrastructure in place so we can provide the relief to the citizens. Please understand why these roads do kind of go through the Kincora project. This is about providing relief for a lot of folks that live west of Loudoun County Parkway. In the evening time, Route 28 backs up from the Waxpool 28 interchange almost all the way down to the toll road and Route 28, and a lot of it is because of the amount of traffic that is getting off of 28 on the Waxpool Road. And then in the morning, Waxpool Road is a parking lot because of the amount of traffic coming out. So I would ask respectfully support for the application, provide the relief to Waxpool Road.
Chairman?
Yeah, Mr. Rich.
I think this is a very reasonable proposal. It makes a lot of sense. We've got a county trying to get out in front of the mess. Otherwise, you know, you're usually waiting, trying to do a catch-up game. The taxpayers are going to, of Loudoun County, are going to end up paying for this thing. 28 is an extremely important corridor for the economic engine of the Commonwealth. The taxpayers paid a lot of those interchange improvements on 28. It's a major north-south route, and we're alleviating significant congestion there, also on Route 7. So
I really think this is a very commendable project, and would recommend that we go forward with this.
I think part of the problem also is the General Assembly passed legislation prohibiting getting the proffers up front, right? So the General Assembly did pass legislation that where you used to be able to maybe get proffers up front before they built, now you can only get them when they...
It's a negotiation. We want, first of all, we want the projects to be able to pay for themselves, but we also have to make sure that the developer is able to move forward with the project, and if we were to get all the funds up front, in a manner of profits, it would be very difficult for the project to get off the ground. But I think legislation has been adopted as such that we have to wait in arrears.
I think it's for cash profits.
Yeah, under the, I'm Mike Scott with the development. In terms of the phasing of the development, two things happened. The Pacific leg of this, the project, actually benefits directly the mixed-use development, which lies to the north end of the property. And so under our phased proper approach, we would not get to Gloucester until last, which is, unfortunately, the road the county needs most critically. So this allows us to do it. We basically, as developers, undertake the burden of basically mortgaging our entire property for this road infrastructure, which completes the Route 28 kind of parallel road network. And in exchange for that, we effectively, because of the attractive interest rate, avoid cost escalations that would be essentially equivalent to what we'd pay over time if we waited 10 years and road costs increased 3% a year.
They've answered my questions.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
These are roads that will be owned by the Commonwealth?
Yes.
Okay. And we own the roads that we're improving or we're adding to now.
Yes.
If you went out and borrowed money in some traditional, some non-VTIB way, you would end up, those roads would belong to us anyway at the end of the time. We would be responsible for maintaining them. Is that correct?
Yes. Right.
So really what we're doing is we're expediting some roads that we think we need. We're creating some opportunity for some economic development in the county. I guess the only question I would ask what is the subsidy anticipated to be, Ms. Fawcett? The interest rate subsidy. There's no subsidy in this one?
We removed the subsidy.
And my question is moved. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm
sorry. Add to that just real quickly. Not only are we building these needed roads looking ahead, but we're augmenting 28 and 7. I mean, we're helping
right,
these
right.
horribly congested yeah. existing roads.
Mr. Secretary?
I'm sorry, Mr. Cole, then Ms. Grisman.
Thank you. Mr. Lawson, what's the proposed repayment schedule?
20.
Thank you.
To maybe alleviate some of Mr. Peake's concerns,
I'm alleviated.
the chairman has spent considerable time with the developer over a number of years to try to come up with a solution for what is one of the worst traffic situations in Northern Virginia. And I think when we made the infrastructure bank available, it was just a matter of them getting their application together, because I know the chairman talked to Doug and I last year about being one of the first applicants. So I think this is we fully support it from the Northern Virginia side.
Can I just add one thing? I think Loudoun County would have really looked at helping out and actually been the ones to implement and do the bonding and move forward with the project. The difficulty for us is that we just simply don't have the capacity. Just to give you an understanding, that since 2000 to 2010, we've built 6 high schools, 8 middle schools, and 21 elementary schools. And we still continue to build because of the growth coming in, and we just don't have the capacity up front to be able to do this.
You've got to tell people to quit moving there.
All right. gentlemen. Thank you very much. Mr. Lawson, finish off your presentation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. I think the next couple slides can go pretty quick. I mean, Dusty covered the 460 application pretty closely. Just, you know, I want to make you aware that we also are looking to have a third application come to us to provide for an $80 million line of credit to support the 6320 Corporation related to Route 460. And just to kind of wrap up with a picture of the bank. As we talked earlier, we capitalized the bank with $283 million. There was an additional $29 million of surplus funds that had been provided through the 2012 session for a total for the bank of $312 million. And with the processing of the Dominion loan and the two we talked about today, that will have fully consumed the funds within the bank.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to pile on to Mr. Lane's earlier comments. And obviously, we don't decide here what our source of revenue is, other than some of these creative things we've been able to do, nor do we decide how much revenue that is. But as I've said a number of times in the Hampton Roads area, you know, the governor and the administration, and with the legislature's approval, have done all the smoke and mirror things that we can do. We've done the Garveys, we did the bank. The bank's now at zero. The Garveys, assuming the numbers that you threw out on the 460 project, are at 200. And we know we're out of money from the transportation fund in 2017. So that's it. We're done. And, you know, unless something changes, unless you find some other great program or some creative method, we're done. And that, you know, the legislature needs to embrace that, and our citizenry needs to embrace that and decide what they want to do. And I know what I want to do, but I don't get to vote other than for my legislators.
Mr. Chairman, and I'd add to Mr. Miller's suggestions there or comments. He didn't mention the $450 million deficit in the maintenance side that looms every year in front of us, and actually deducts from the amount of money that's available for us to do these projects. So that's high on our list of needs as we talk to legislators and those that can fund important projects in Virginia.
Just a quick question. Mr. Lawson, do you expect an incremental some increment of funds to come from FY13 budget surplus?
Obviously, we can't assume anything there. You know, there's, you know, money dedicated. A portion of the surplus is dedicated to transportation. It will be, you know, incumbent upon the governor then to decide whether or not, you know, how he wants to direct the use of those funds.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Yeah.
So at this point, Mr. Lawson, we have, once the banking's exhausted, that's it. We have no way of replenishing anything in there at this point.
Short of recapitalization, the bank will not have any additional funds to work with.
Until at least 17.
No,
yeah, but it's the intent of the governor to continue to push for the money to be put on every surplus, which up to this point, I mean, if they hadn't rated it again this year, it would have been another 65-70 million.
$65-70 million. And on that topic, like that, on the full circle here, the only direction we've really gotten from the legislature after all this is devolution. Take a look at it. So that's really the action that was all boiled down with all the legislative agenda the governor put forward. The only action they've really given us is to study devolution. That's the fact of it.
That's a bad.
We were having such a great trip until you guys kind of made it a bummer. all right,
Mr.
Chairman, there's a lot of friends.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick thing. Mr. Keene, I think, appropriately brought up the maintenance issue. We haven't had a briefing on maintenance. Maybe we could have one next time. I don't know where we are on that. It seems like that's a continuing problem.
at putting that on the agenda next time to just find out where we are on maintenance, especially in light of our approval of a 6-year plan, whether we have enough in there or not. I'm sure my other colleagues would like to know.
Sure, we'll make it part of the 6-year plan presentation. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Garvey's.
All right. I think this can go pretty fast, given that we had a significant discussion about the Garvey program earlier. Just by way of overview and refresher, the Garveys were authorized by the 2011 General Assembly. They are the successor program to the FRANS. The FRAN program was effectively sunset by the Garvey legislation. The Garvey program retained the $1.2 billion revolving authorization that was provided for the FRANS. Over the course of the 10 years or so, that we had the FRAN program in place, we had issued $1.1 billion in FRANs. At this point, only $176.6 million remain outstanding. And that amount will be fully repaid by 2015. As you recall, the first Garvey sale was done just a few months ago, back in February. It was a sale done to support the public subsidy for the Midtown Tunnel project. It was a 15-year term bond with a true interest cost of 2.4%. Today, I'll be seeking in the action meeting your approval to move forward with the second sale. The second sale will be seeking funding for two projects. An additional $50 million for the Midtown Tunnel project to support the delay in tolling to July of 2014, and as well as the monies for the I-95 express lane. As Dusty mentioned earlier, we think that subsidy amount today is $92 million. We have a little leeway here just as we're working toward that close, and we may need to adjust that amount, but it should not be above $100 million. From a statutory perspective, again, the chapters 830 and 868 of the 2011 Acts of Assembly established the Garvey program. The program is very similar to the FRANS, with the exception that the term was shortened, the FRANS were 10-year notes. The Garvey program can be as long as 20 years. All their planned sales are for 15-year terms. In addition to the federal legislation, the state legislation that authorizes the Garveys, we have a memorandum of agreement in place with Federal Highway that we executed last December that sets forth the responsibilities of the two parties and explains how we will administer the program. It's kind of an evergreen agreement in that we don't have to amend the agreement other than to add to the approved project list. We've already had discussions with Federal Highway related to the I-95 project, and the list will be amended to include the project. There was some discussion earlier about the authorization. As mentioned, we have the $1.2 billion revolving authorization. First thing we have to look at, though, is the outstanding FRANS. If you look at the Garveys that are outstanding from the first sale, and the planned sale of $150 million, these are available authorization of just shy of $600 million. And as I mentioned earlier, that $176 million of FRANS will be repaid in 2015. The debt service on the Garveys, it is also a little different structure than the FRANS. We call the FRANS what we call indirect Garveys. Just paid for out of general federal revenues. With the Garveys, they are specifically tied to a project. So the revenues that are received specifically to Midtown Tunnel, or in this case, the I-95, will be those revenues that will be used to support the debt service. Air Garvey program is also strengthened by added security of revenues from other legally available sources of the Transportation Trust Fund, and any other funds that may be designated by the General Assembly. The two Garvey issues combined, one for Midtown in February and this issue, combined, we'll have an annual debt service of about $40 million. And just to kind of put that in perspective, the total revenues collected in fiscal year 2011 were about $1.1 billion. This just gives you a little snapshot of some recent Garvey transactions. They continue to trade very strong. In fact, New Hampshire had an issue yesterday that the spreads were within about 30 basis points of AAA-MD. So they just continue to trade very strong. As you can see here, air rating, the first one represents the sale from February. Because of the added security, you can see the air rating notch above the others. And combination of the enhanced rating as well as good timing in the market, you can see here our interest rate was much lower than the other issues. Again, we are looking to go to sale with a pricing in the June-July period, again, for about $150 million with 15-year maturity. We do expect to get the AA rating as is obtained on the initial sale. This just gives you kind of a schedule that we plan to work through. We will be updating the project list as part of the MOA with Fort Holly this month. We'll be seeking rating requests in June, as well as we'll be going to go to the Treasury Board next month to obtain their approval. We'll do the pricing and sale late June, July, with the closing in early July. Just all in time to support the July closing of the I-95 project, which the Dusty discussed earlier. I've got Officer Anderson, bond counsel, is here also. If you have any questions.
Just a real quick, Mr. Chair. Where is this $150 million going that we're going to, can you just tell us where it's going?
The $150, $50 million of it will go towards the downtown Midtown tunnel. And the other $100 is slated for the, we'll cover the $92 million that Dusty talked about earlier as a subsidy for the
$95.
Good,
thank you.
Okay, financial report.
Okay. April was a pretty good month in terms of revenue. We've seen a little bit of an uptick in what we've been seeing in the previous months. Revenues are about 3% ahead of where they were the prior fiscal year, which is also good in that it's slightly above the forecasted growth rate of 2.2%. Motor vehicle sales continue to be strong. Year-to-date growth of just over 8%, which is about almost double the 4% growth that was expected. Motor fuel tax collections, while still down from last year, are better than, well, I can't say better than initially forecasted. Initially, we had forecasted a growth of about just shy of 3%. They reduced that expected growth to a decline of 1.4% in December. We're currently at about a 1% decline. At least we're doing a little better than most recent forecasts. And sales and use tax are just very slightly behind the forecast, 5.4 versus 5.8. This chart, you see it every month, just gives you the details by revenue source, comparing the amount, the estimate, the collections through April, for both fiscal year 12 versus 11, and then the comparison between the actual change and the forecasted growth. Federal revenues are also running above fiscal year 11 levels. We're about $51 million ahead of where we were last fiscal year. The majority of that growth, actually all of that growth, is attributable to that work done in the maintenance program. Looking at spending through April, collectively across all programs, we spent nearly $3.2 billion, which is almost $400 million ahead of where we were last year. 44% of the spending relates to VDOT's maintenance program. And when you look at maintenance spending collectively to include payments to localities, it represents 53% of spending. Construction spending represents about 34% of the total. This just graphically gives you the year-over-year comparison of spending. And as you can see, most of the programs are very similar to the prior fiscal year. You see the slight growth in construction and the considerable growth in maintenance. Speaking of maintenance, we expended $123 million in April, about $1.4 billion spent to date. That's a 34% increase over where we were as of this time last year. Anticipate spending about $1.7 billion by the end of the fiscal year. While we're to date, we're at about $100 million below our spend plan, and we think we'll end the year just over $200 million below this. I'll have an allocation balance of just over $200 million.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
You just corrected yourself on spend plan versus allocation, or you changed your terminology. And what I've been always trying to pull out of this, as you know, is one thing about how much money is coming in, it's another thing about what our real plan is. Old money, new money. And
they were two separate statements.
Right.
We were about $100 million behind where we thought we would be.
On our spend plan.
On our spend plan. And in terms of allocation, unspent funding, we think we'll end the year at about $228 million of unspent funding.
And how much of that is, how much is the total spend plan variance at the end of the year?
The spend plan variance at the end of the year would have been at about the 100 million point.
At the end of the year. So there's 128 in additional money. It was not in our spend plan, it was in our balance.
So, or didn't get spent,
yeah. Yeah, because, yes. Not expected to be expended.
Right, it went in the spend plan, but it's in the balance.
Right.
Gotcha. Thank you.
In terms of construction, it's expended about $1.1 billion this year, which is about a 5% increase over last year. And the actual spending is about $20 million above forecast. See here that the spending kind of varies as to where it is. The greater increase, really the main increases taking place within the primary and urban systems. In terms of anticipated spending, this just gets back to what we were talking about just momentarily minutes ago there. You see that it shows the operating budget compared to the original forecast versus where we are, our forecast is today, a big increase there within the construction arena. And then you look at forecasted spending today versus the actual expenditures today. Even across all programs, we're about $100 million below the forecast. In terms of cash, you can see that the change here in cash position for the major programs year over year, or since the beginning of the year, I should say. When you look at cash in grand total, we're only about $35 million below where we began the year, but you have to take into consideration the $360 million of post-carbon proceeds that came in additional. So there's some significant spend down, as you can see, in the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund, as well as in the CPR bond proceeds. And then just kind of summarizing, our CTF revenues are ahead of forecast by almost 1%. Our current contract value on our existing contract totals $2.7 billion, which is almost $500 billion greater than it was at this time last year. So we're definitely putting out contracts to move work. Fiscal year-to-date expenditures, as you saw from that graphic, most programs are fairly much in line with their forecasted activity. And good news, I think, is the unspent balance of $228 million I mentioned earlier, the maintenance program, is half of what, less than half of what it was at the end of last fiscal year. So that number, we were over $500 million, go back 2 years, came down to $485 last year, and then we're looking at this year being slightly above $200. So we're
doing much better.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Coulombe, this is Dr. Davis.
Mr. Lawson, can you go back to slide 8? I just have a quick question about why there's a significant difference in the program management direction totals. Is that the nature of the contracts? Is that localities and PPTAs managing contracts? Is it efficiencies?
We last year, when we developed the fiscal year 12 budget, we made a very concerted effort to streamline construction management. Also a significant amount of called construction engineering inspection funding actually provided on projects for people to be charging to versus to be charging to an administrative overhead account. So that was a very intentional action that we made last year during budget development to constrain construction management.
Well, congratulations. It worked.
Mr. Chairman, is there a reasonable expectation if the Commonwealth spends $250 million on infrastructure more in 1 year than did the previous year, of the impact that has on the Virginia economy? I know it's positive, but I'm just trying to figure out if there's a reasonable expectation that we could talk about that would say, because we got $250 million more out this year than last year, it had this impact on the Virginia economy.
What's the multiplier? We have various studies that we've done. Some of on bigger numbers, but we can brush them up for some of the projects we're doing now.
It's just a general observation, but I've noticed in areas of the Commonwealth where we have accelerated and have major projects underway, there appears to be improving employment, improving economic activity, and it should be a pretty clear message that infrastructure investment in the Commonwealth is a very positive thing.
Mr. Chairman, I think you would typically say, an economist would say, it's about 2 to 2.5 times the amount you spend is what the impact would be. So if we spend $250 million, you're talking, $500-$700 million of GDP into the state economy, which is significant.
We can go and try to get those, brush up those numbers. I'm sorry, Ms. Lane.
I just want to make a comment and commend the commissioner and staff. At least in the Hampton Roads District, they're doing a very good job of communicating road closures, getting out. I've had lots of positive comments about people. Not happy that the roads are closed, but they're happy that they've been communicated to. And so I just commend you for that informational campaign.
Okay. Mr. Brule? Economic Development Access Program.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. The presentation I have for you today is directly tied to our business plan, which the Chief Deputy Commissioner and Commissioner presented to you previously. What we're going to talk about today is Objective 5.3, which is improving access to multimodal facilities and major employment centers over the next 3 years. We're looking to do that with some modifications to our Economic Development Access Program. Just to give you a little background and a summary of our existing program, the board has a policy which was last revisited in 2010 when we increased the maximum allocation available under the program to a total of $650,000 per project, which is inclusive of design and construction. We have two types of projects under the EDA program. We have regular projects. That's where you have an existing located industry that's expanding, much like the project we had last month in the city of Virginia Beach, where you know that they're there, you know what they're doing, or a new industry coming in that's been named, qualifies for the program, and those projects are the most clean and straightforward. We also have a number of bonded projects. Those are the types of projects where we don't have a qualifying industry that's been named, or the naming of that industry is still kept in secret. In those projects, the locality that's applying for funding is required to provide a bond or a surety to VDOT, and there's a 5-year time frame that locality has to establish that qualifying establishment and investment in that facility. By board policy, our capital investment to program project cost ratio is 5-1. Our qualifying capital investment is pretty well defined by the board's policy in that only private investment is currently eligible, and our qualifying establishments are also defined by that policy. They're listed on the screen, but things like government installations, public facilities, commercial establishments, they do not qualify for Economic Development Access funding. We work on those eligibility determinations very closely with the Economic Development Partnership, and they coordinate and consult with the Virginia Department of Business Assistance in doing those evaluations. The next few slides in my presentation actually come from the Virginia Economic Development Partnership. As indicated, we work pretty closely with them. And they shared with us that we've missed, as Commonwealth, we've missed some opportunities over the last few years where if we had sites that had better access and were more ready for development, we would have had other opportunities to bring economic development to Virginia. The list of manufacturers and industries that are on the slide now all expressed interest in coming to Virginia between 2005 and 2012. But we didn't have sites that were available at that time to accommodate them. And the next slide, two essential ingredients that we've learned working through VEDP for having a successful outcome in economic development and attracting these major investments to Virginia are having well-documented site plans, including construction-ready road plans, and having pre-existing infrastructure on the sites, including completed road facilities. Those major investors, those major economic development that were on the other side, on the other slide, are looking for sites that they can have ready and have their facility up and running in 18 to 24 months. And if you don't have those plans ready and you don't have the facilities in place, it's very difficult to accommodate them. The Code of Virginia defines a major employment and investment project as one that has a capital investment exceeding $250 million and creating more than 400 new full-time jobs. The Virginia Economic Development Partnership has developed an initiative for strategic properties, or what they refer to as megasites, based on this definition, and they've been working with localities and economic development authorities across the state to identify sites that provide opportunities to attract these types of projects. The seven sites that are listed on the slide are the ones that are currently identified by VEDP to meet that criteria. And each of those sites currently has inadequate access to public roads.
Mr. Chairman? Yes, Mr. Bull, if you went back to the essential ingredients, one of which is the access, how about the workforce solutions, the site development plans, and the other infrastructure? Do they meet, do these ones that you have listed here, these seven, do they meet those criteria as well?
That question would be better posed to the Virginia Economic Development Partnership than us.
I guess my point is, it's one thing for us to put some money into a place to create the access, but if the other essential elements aren't there, we're just parking money where it doesn't need to be parked.
VEDP is working aggressively with those seven sites to make sure that all the ingredients are in place. We're partnering with them on the roadway access, but they're very actively engaged with those localities and those sites to get those industries there.
So obviously the sort of takeaway would be, at least my opinion would be, that I would be happy to do that as long as the other essential ingredients were there, or we're going to be there in a short amount of time. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I noticed there's no site along 460 as a mega site. Why is that?
We don't have the road access with what 460 will do or provide.
Premature. It's not really developed enough to get on this list yet. Okay.
It will be
being certified mega sites.
Mega.
Okay.
And these seven sites are already very well developed and advanced in terms of having site plans in place. Some of them, Progress Park in the county, has already got a number of phases that have been developed. So they're a little bit further down the road. That's why the wording is pretty careful on the slide. That these are seven sites that are currently identified. That's not the only seven sites that could be identified.
Thank you.
So working with VEBP, we wanted to know how the existing Economic Development Access Program could be made more flexible for the mega sites and for other economic development sites across the Commonwealth. And in working with them, we pulled together a number of stakeholders Basically spend a day with them talking about their issues with the program, what we could do to make the program more flexible and more beneficial to their economic development efforts. That dialogue resulted in a number of recommendations that I'll walk through quickly with you now. First recommendation for megasites, the focus group suggested that we implement a separate funding program or separate funding opportunity for the planning phase. Right now, I mentioned in an earlier slide, they have one chance to come to us for an allocation that covers the planning and the construction. So what they would like us to do is to fund the design and the construction of these access roads as two distinct projects. The megasite facilities are much more complex than our typical access projects. The planning phase is much more detailed than our typical access projects. And staff agrees that this is is a needed change that would help advance those projects. And having those road construction plans ready to go on the shelf and the project be shovel ready is certainly something that makes the site more viable for the large industry.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Jennifer, how was the focus groups selected and organized?
The focus group members were identified by the Virginia Economic Development Partnership, and so they represent the 7 mega sites, but all those localities are also very active in our regular EDA program. Now, due to the greater length of the access roads in the megasites, the focus group also identified a need to increase the maximum allocation for these types of projects. Staff's recommending allowing an allocation of up to $1 million per year for a megasite project with a local match of $500,000, and allowing those localities to come back in a subsequent year for another allocation of up to $1 million with a local match of $500,000. So this formula will provide them with a multiple year total of up to $2 million in state allocations matched with up to $1 million in local allocations for a total of $3 million.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Brewer, relative to your previous comment about breaking the planning from the construction, and then you use the words in this $1 million focus group suggestion of road construction but not planning, is that a separate deal here?
They would still be able to come to us for a separate allocation for the planning phase, and then these
which
two
would be still at 650.
Yes.
So we keep the planning, we break them apart, we keep the planning numbers where they are now, but then they could come back for an additional $2 million, $1 million at a time,
right,
for construction.
With an increased local match. Right, so now they can get $500,000 to know.
So ultimately we would move from 650 to $2,650,000 as a limit.
Potentially.
With more match, of course, but that's what would come out of our coffers at the highest.
Right. And as an example, we actually have on your action agenda today an allocation for one of these megasite locations in Carroll County. As an example with that one, they can only ask for $650,000 right now, but the road construction alone on that project is well over $1 million.
And would you tie in your recommendation, do you tie the gap in terms of time between the planning and the construction to some sort of, is there some criteria for that? I mean, obviously, we wouldn't really necessarily want to do a planning 650 if we thought construction was going to be 12 years from now. We might wait on that.
What we're looking at is that the having the plans ready so that the road construction can be shovel ready is so important on these sites. What we would do is have them bond the planning phase until the road plans are complete and approved for construction by VDOT. Then we would release the bond. We would have a separate bonded period for each of the construction phases.
Fine. Thank you.
Switching from, we didn't talk with the focus group just about the mega sites. We also talked about the EDA program in general and asked them for some suggestions on what we could do to improve for the more routine projects. And one thing that the focus group suggested to us was government facilities are not currently eligible as a qualifying establishment, and they recommended that we consider allowing both federal government and nonprofit development and investment to count towards that qualifying investment on the project. Staff recommendation is to open that qualifying establishment up to government facilities and make that change in the policy. We did not include the nonprofit in our proposed policy.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Dr.
Is there a reason?
I think it's program's been around for a while. We've made a number of changes over the past few years. Not knowing how that's going to change the complexion of the program, we figure we take one step with the government installations and can change that nonprofit in the subsequent year.
I would have expected it to be reversed.
The focus group seemed more focused to me on the government installations. That was a bigger issue for them, but we can go back and look at that if that's something the board wants to do.
So that precludes our major universities and colleges, though, then, right?
Right now, those types of public facilities are not eligible.
See, and they're on the cutting edge of a lot of things that can create jobs in the Commonwealth. I mean, I speak for knowing that at George Mason, and I'm sure UVA or Tech or Shenandoah will be the same situation.
Yes.
That seems incongruent in what we're trying to do.
Was there a specific discussion of, say, situations like Fort Monroe, in other words, federal properties that are coming through, obviously?
There was a lot of discussion related to BRAC and military facilities and having sites that are open for that type of investment location.
I can see, Mr. Chairman, that there is going to be another round of BRAC, but there also is going to be a round of non-military BRAC, if you want to call it that, as the federal government's spending plans change and they're faced with consolidating operations, headquarters, offices, just like everybody else. So this may be something that has a little more urgency than it would appear.
Yes.
Sort of what Mr. Miller was talking about, the nonprofits looking ahead. Since a lot of hospitals are nonprofits. All right, and so I don't see the real, I mean, it seems like to me if we open up for one, we ought to open up for both of them. I mean, if it's economic development, I mean, it's form over substance, right? I mean, mm-hmm. So I would encourage the staff to take a look at opening up also for nonprofits.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a prejudice against nonprofits for fear that they're not going to be paying taxes. And it's a little bit true for governments as well, unless they have impact fees that are oftentimes paid. But I take the example of what's happening here in Southwest Virginia with the law school and the pharmacy school could be greatly benefited by being able to also access these funds, open up sites for those educational facilities. But I do understand the prejudice that they're against not-for-profits because of the local tax issue.
And I think one of the items that concern staff a little bit is if there's only $5.5 million a year that comes into this fund for economic development access and rail industrial access. And over the past few years, we haven't had as many requests, but we've had funding built up in that fund. But if we open it too broadly, we could very quickly burn down what money is available and be turning folks away. So it's a matter of priority.
We want to spend it?
Yeah, we want to spend it.
We want to spend it.
We want to create the job.
Yeah, I mean, God forbid we make too many jobs.
We can look at that.
I'll get it.
Mr. Chairman, let me elaborate a little bit. You know, to Dr. Davis's point, I understand the real estate tax piece, but obviously that's not what it's all about. It's not totally what it's all about. There are other things that come out of any entity, whether it's spending, whether it's jobs and spending, whether, you know, buying from vendors, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, eating restaurants, whatever it is. And we have these funds here, to Mr. Lane's point, for a reason, and to create more value by spending them than by keeping them. I mean, if we don't want more of it, then we ought to send it all back, do none of it. The more of this we can do, if we can spend $2 and make $6, that's what we want to do. So I don't really care whether it's a private sector, a public sector, a not-for-profit sector. I don't care what it is. If I can spend $2 and get $6 or $2 and get $4, I want to do that. And as far as I'm concerned, everything else being equal, which perhaps it's not, but everything else being equal, you know, first come, first serve, it's sort of like a project. Let's get it done. Let's get the job created. Let's get the economic development happening. And if it's the government versus the private sector versus whatever, as long as they're spinning off more value to us than it costs us, then I think we want to do that. We want to spend it as fast as we can. If we weren't getting the value, then we should spend none of it.
All right, a couple more recommendations. One of the things that the localities on a focus group recommended was that we allow them to get credit for the locally funded public infrastructure that they're putting into these sites. A lot of the localities are buying the land, they're constructing shell buildings to attract business to the site. Right now that doesn't count as part of that qualifying investment credit, and we're also concurring with that recommendation and have included that language in the policy. Another suggestion from the focus group was to allow reimbursement of design costs incurred prior to CTB approval. As it stands right now, anything the locality does before you take action and allocate funding is not eligible. Staff recommended no change in policy on that right now. Most of, based on our projects and our project history, we're not fully funding projects to start with, and so this would further dilute how much money that
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Going back to your previous suggestion, if local government is going to do something and we do it for them instead, I'm not sure that's a good thing for us if they're going to already do it. And so in this suggestion of giving credit for locally funded public infrastructure improvements to attract economic development, how do you sort of justify that? Are you suggesting they wouldn't do this? Or are you suggesting we're just going to help them after they've done it, or help them more? I mean, it's sort of like, I don't want to fund it if they're already going to do it.
No, you're not, in this situation, you're not funding it. What you're allowing them to do is for those bonded projects where the locality doesn't have a named industry, they've got 5-year time period to qualify investment that offsets how much you've allocated.
Right.
In some cases, we get to the end of that 5-year period and the locality has to repay the amount that's been allocated from the Economic Development Access Fund. What this would allow them to do is, if they don't have a named industry, they could at least recoup some credit for their investment on the site to reduce their bonded repayment on that property.
But we're still paying it, because otherwise we'd get it back. So call it, you can use whatever word you want, but we have less money at the end than we would have otherwise had. And I guess my concern is, we want the local government to have some skin in the game when they're coming to us asking for the access funds to do this project, in the sense that they've got some skin, they've got some risk, and you know, some. I don't know how much. Obviously, we want them to be aggressive and we want to help them, because at the end of the day, we want it to be successful. But if we take all their skin out of the game, I'm afraid we're going to get to a point where there's no reason not to ask, because there's no risk. And I would, you know, be that as it would play out, you just ask every time, because you may win and you may not, but if you have no risk, it's like playing the lottery, but it doesn't cost anything. Why would you not do it?
There's still pretty significant risks on the localities, and that transitions into my next slide. In October of 2010, this board established a bond moratorium for projects that were approved by the board between 2005 and 2009 based on the economic downturn. A lot of projects were having a hard time attracting that industry because the economic development just wasn't coming into the state. That's a risk on the localities for having to repay those bond costs. That bond moratorium is scheduled to expire July 1st. This year. There's concern that the economy hasn't bounced back to the level that these folks can really attract the kind of business that they need. And we have 4 projects that we would have to call bonds on in July if that bond moratorium is not extended. So staff's going to recommend by resolution next month that we extend the existing moratorium and then put a moratorium in place for those projects whose bond would expire between July 1st of this year and July 1st of 2014. To extend their bonded period, that would cover 6 projects. So we're talking about a total of 10 projects statewide. Last recommendation comes from staff, and this is to set aside up to 1% of the EDA funds per year. That's up to $55,000. for program administration to allow us to be more aggressive in what we do in terms of outreach, communication with the economic development community, working with the Virginia Economic Development Partnership to bring more of these projects to reality. In terms of next steps, we're going to bring you two items at next month's CTB meeting for consideration. One is the policy change, which you have a draft in your package. And the second is the extension of the bond moratorium. That would be by resolution as well, with the intent of us coming back to the development community with a revised program and economic development access guide by the end of the year.
Is there consideration to expand that focus group to maybe some of those outside the mega projects?
We had a broader focus group in 2007 when we made some changes based on code. That was the policy change prior to the 2010 change. So we had a much broader focus group at that time. Because this was focused more on the strategic properties initiatives, working with the EDC, we had the smaller focus group at this time. But we welcome input from anybody in the development community that has suggestions on how to improve the program.
Any other questions? Mr. Rule, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that finishes out the workshop, and now we'll get into the regular meeting.